From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Election Day is next Tuesday, and some people worry elections will be rigged. Michigan's top election guy says, seriously, it's not a problem.
We have no real concern about any rigging of elections. And anybody who really takes the time to study our election system would know the absurdity of those statements.
Also, the Democrat running for the 8th Congressional District.
And I'm hearing from the voters everywhere that they're tired of the partisanship, they're tired of the broken Congress, they're tired of their representative who goes to bat for special interests and lobbyists instead of them.
Then a talk about wrongful convictions.
African Americans are more likely to be wrongfully convicted than white people are.
We'll find out why. Then we'll have some keen insight into time change.
Little known fact, everyone, I mean everyone, is far more attractive in the dark.
First, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Election Day is finally almost here, but we've had a lot of questions. There's been a lot of talk about poll challengers, poll watchers, and that's in addition to the actual poll workers. Joining us now is Michigan's Secretary of State Director of Elections, Chris Thomas. So are there concerns about voter intimidation? What is a poll challenger or a poll watcher allowed to do?
Let me first say to voters that they should have no concerns or fear of coming to the polls. They will be well run. They will not tolerate any disruption. And so we have good regulations, tight regulations around what poll watchers can do and what challengers can do. Challengers are provided for in the election law. Generally, they are with the political parties. They cannot be with a candidate. They do have the right to look at documents, and they have the right to challenge voters if they have good reason to believe that that voter is not 18 or does not live in the precinct or is not properly registered or is not a United States citizen.
Can anyone come in and say, I'm a poll challenger?
No. You have to have credentials from the political party or outfit that's sponsoring you. You have to show those to the chairperson in the polling place before you can go to work.
Can I confront, if I'm one of those poll watchers or poll challengers, can I confront a voter?
No. You're not allowed to have any discussion with voters. Anything you want to do by way of challenging a voter is done through the precinct inspector. They're the officials that run the election.
If we have somebody who comes in and decides he or she is going to be an ad hoc poll challenger or a watcher, what does the precinct committee people do? I mean, precinct chairperson do about that? I mean, is it a matter of just calling the cops, or do they try to kick them out themselves? Because I got to tell you, at my polling place, I've got a bunch of retirees working as poll workers. I'm not sure anybody's going to be kicking out a 45-year-old guy or woman out of the polling place.
Well, our challengers are really well trained. You know that.
In Taekwondo? Or?
Yeah, we don't tell. I mean, that'll be the surprise. But seriously, let me also say what a poll watcher is. So a poll watcher is different from a challenger. They don't have any status at all. So they can go stand in a roped-off public area and watch. That's all they can do.
So that might be a reporter like me or something.
Yeah,
a reporter,
exactly. They have that kind of access. So, I mean, the polling place is a public place. So if somebody comes in, they don't have any credentials, and they decide that they're going to be a full-fledged challenger, they will be asked to go stand in the box and remain silent. If they don't do that and they continue to be disruptive, they'll be asked to leave once. If they don't leave, the police will be there to escort them out.
I want to ask you about a few other things. Let's just go down the list here. Voter identification, you're going to be asked for a photo ID. But if you don't have one or you didn't bring one with you, you will be asked to sign an affidavit, and then you can vote. So will that ballot be counted alongside all the rest of them?
Oh, absolutely. So there's two tracks. One, if you have an ID with you on your body, you are required to show it. So either a driver's license or a personal ID card issued by Michigan or even another state, federal or state government issued IDs, passport, military ID, student identification from a high school or accredited institution of higher education, or a tribal identification card with a photo. Those are the acceptable IDs. If you don't have an ID with you, then you'll sign the affidavit, as you said, and then that ballot will be counted. So under no circumstances is that a reason not to count a ballot.
Let's go to voting straight party ticket. That was a big deal earlier this year. What is the latest? What is the final for Tuesday? Can we vote a straight party ticket or not?
Yes, you can. When you get to the polling place and are issued your ballot, or if you get an absentee ballot, you will see that the straight party area is on that ballot. And so you have three choices. You can vote straight party. You can vote a split ticket, which means you can vote one of the parties, fill in the oval, and then you can go vote for candidates in other race, other parties as well.
And we want to remind everybody that there are a number of candidates at the bottom who are not affiliated with a party, and you have to do your homework on that, as well as there are referenda in many of these communities that you might want to take a look at that rather than just check one box and leave the polling booth. Let's move on to photographing ballots, or what everybody's been calling ballot selfies. That's changed back and forth a couple of times. What's the latest on that?
Well, the law still remains in effect.
So that's a ban on ballot selfies.
A ban on exposing your ballot. And that goes back to the 1890s. And when you read the history of that period and you see what was going on.
Not a lot of selfie taking back then.
Not a lot of selfies, but a lot of exposure. There were a lot of businesses and a lot of political machines that intimidated people to show their ballot before it was put in the can to verify that those people were voting in the manner that their bosses wanted them to. And this law came in with the Australian ballot, which was the first real secret ballot, and it had to come in to make sure that the exposure stopped. And it's been a great law. We don't see much of that going on at all anymore, and we'd like to keep it that way.
One other thing at the polls, it says that you shouldn't be wearing campaign buttons or campaign shirts or other things like that within the polling place. But if I come in and my T-shirt just says, "Make America Great Again," or "I'm with her," am I going to be asked to leave?
You won't be asked to leave. You may be asked to go into the restroom and turn your T-shirt inside out. Those two slogans that you just mentioned are identified with the two major party candidates. We went to federal court back when President Obama was originally elected, and the argument there was all the gear that was out at that time with his slogans on it, and the federal judge upheld the law that said that you cannot display those in the polling place or within 100 feet of the door.
Chris, I want to ask you one more thing. You are the director of elections. There have been a lot of accusations across the nation about how the elections are rigged. I don't know. I'm not in your shoes, but if I were, I think I'd take that personally. Your credibility is being questioned here. What do you think of that?
Well, I think it's a lot of nonsense. It's a lot of chatter. And when people make those allegations, they should be coming forward with their specifics if they're serious. If it's just campaign chatter, well, I guess that's what the First Amendment's all about. But we have no real concern about any rigging of elections. And anybody who really takes the time to study our election system would know the absurdity of those statements.
I'm just glad Michigan has paper ballots and no chads to speak of.
We can do without chads, and we're very happy to have paper.
All right, that's Director of Elections at the Michigan Secretary of State's office, Chris Thomas. He's in charge of making sure your election goes well on Tuesday. Thanks very much.
My pleasure.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. We've been bringing you Artisans of Michigan, and today's latest, we'll be visiting Lansing's Old Town neighborhood. Welcome to Elderly Instruments. Now, if you've been a musician for a while, you probably know about Elderly. It became famous because of its catalogs and its well-stocked store back in the day. And when the internet came along, the store's following kind of made the transition to online. The walls and racks are full of acoustic guitars, electric guitars, mandolins, violins, banjos, and more. And it seems like somebody's always grabbing up a guitar and playing a little bit. But we're going downstairs to meet someone.
I'm Joe Conkley. I'm the head repair person and manager of the repair shop here at Elderly Instruments in Lansing, Michigan.
There are 10 craftsmen down here repairing guitars and other stringed instruments. Most have some kind of specialty. Joe Conkley likes to work with vintage Martin guitars. He also restores mandolins and banjos.
I get a deep satisfaction out of just being around these instruments and handling the vintage stuff is anything from the 1920s all the way through the 60s. And I really love connecting with the artisans who originally made these instruments and preserving them in that way.
Conkley says he first started repairing guitars out of necessity when he was young, playing in a band and teaching guitar.
Many of my students had guitars that they couldn't really learn on. So my father was a woodworker with a fairly well-equipped shop, and he and I started reading some books together. I started trying to take care of these guitars so that I could get more students.
He went to school in the early 80s, learned his craft, eventually started working at Elderly, where he's found a home.
I like the fact that we actually produce something here in the shop. You know, hands-on stuff. I love that aspect of it. I love working with a team of guys. It happens to be guys right now, but the camaraderie and the information exchange and the learning process of getting better.
Conkley and most of his colleagues actually make guitars in their home shops. Conkley was even involved in designing a new line of acoustic guitars for a Chinese company that Elderly Instruments carries. The craftsmen in the Elderly basement have always wanted to make guitars right here, but they've always been so busy just fixing the damaged, abused, or just worn out guitars coming through the door. And so it's neck resets, refrets like Joe Conkley is doing right now, making new bridges, gluing old ones, or fixing some of the internal structure to bring some of these instruments back to life. Little riff on the guitar was by one of the other Elderly Instrument repair guys, Steve Olson. Coming up next, a conversation with the Democratic candidate for the 8th Congressional District, Susanna Shkreli. And then, a new film explores the militarization of police. We'll talk with the filmmaker. You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. The race in the 8th Congressional District has been interesting this year. First, Melissa Gilbert, the former child star of TV's Little House on the Prairie, became the Democratic challenger to incumbent Republican Mike Bishop. Then Gilbert dropped out for health reasons. Democrats had to pick a new candidate, and they chose a Macomb County Assistant Prosecutor, Susanna Shkreli. She joins us now. So you started late in this race in the district that seemed pretty safe for the incumbent. Why did you decide to take on this challenge, this candidacy?
Well, Lester, as a prosecutor, I spend my days in the courtroom fighting to protect our most vulnerable women and children from physical and sexual abuse. And taking on those tough fights every day to keep dangerous predators off the street gave me the tenacity to take this challenge on for Michigan's 8th District. And I'm hearing from the voters everywhere that they're tired of the partisanship, they're tired of the broken Congress, they're tired of their representative who goes to bat for special interests and lobbyists instead of them. And they want somebody like me to stick up for them and fight for middle-class families. And that's why I decided to run.
Congressman Bishop has said he's appalled by the comments Donald Trump made about groping women in a recording from 2005. But Bishop has not withdrawn his support for Trump. What are voters telling you about that?
Mike Bishop wants to distance himself from Donald Trump, and he does the best he can in trying to do that. But the voters want to know. I'm hearing from everywhere. They want to know whether their congressman supports Donald Trump, whether he continues to endorse him, whether he is going to vote for him. And, you know, they find it appalling, and I think everybody in this district finds it appalling, and that any GOP member can still stick by Donald Trump after he's denigrated a war hero. He's made fun of a disabled reporter, insulted the family of a fallen soldier, and now brags about sexual assault, and then made a comment 2 weeks ago about rigged elections and undermining our democracy. I mean, you can't have it both ways. You can't serve two masters. I mean, it just goes to show you that he can't stand up and stick up for Michigan's 8th District if he can't stand up to Donald Trump.
You've surprised some pundits by raising quite a bit of cash, a pretty significant amount of money coming to the race and endorsements, including President Obama. What's that done for your ability to compete in the race?
You know, we knew that this race was competitive when we got in, and I am honored by the grassroots support that we have throughout this district. Most of that money is individual contributions from people that are tired of the partisanship and tired of Mike Bishop. And endorsements like President Obama, these things are, you know, is just a testament to how hard we've been working. And it's with that same work ethic and that grit that we're going to fight for Michigan's middle-class families once we're elected.
Let's talk about policy priorities, the differences between you and Mr. Bishop. What do you want to do in Congress that Mike Bishop is not doing?
Well, I hear from everywhere from folks that we need access to good-paying jobs, and I'm going to fight to protect the jobs that we have by voting against job-killing trade deals. Mike Bishop comes out in the public and says that he's against TPP, but he voted to fast-track it, and that's going to decimate our manufacturing sector here in Michigan. And we can't always be on the losing side of these trade deals. I'm also hearing from folks as well that, you know, they want a representative who's going to protect their Social Security and Medicare. And I'm going to do that. I'm going to fight to protect Social Security and Medicare by opposing any attempt to privatize Social Security or turn Medicare into a voucher system. Our seniors have spent their whole working lives paying into these programs, and they deserve to rely on them in retirement. And as somebody who's a saddled with student loans, somebody who knows the problems firsthand of the rising cost of tuition, I'm going to fight to make college more affordable so our students can build that house and start that family once they graduate. They're not able to do so, you know, when they're leaving college saddled with mountains of student loan debt.
We'd like to categorize people. I mean, it's just human nature. So do you consider yourself a liberal, a moderate? What do you call yourself?
If you're going to label me, I consider myself a moderate. I'm somebody who's willing to stand up to both parties to fight for an agenda that is going to push Michigan's families forward.
The 8th District is pretty white. It leans conservative. You've got your own principles, but how much do you take into account the people of the district on issues where the majority of the district might disagree with your positions?
That's part of the job as a representative, is to listen to the district and make decisions that's going to push us forward. And I'm all about getting to know the constituents and continuing to push Michigan's middle-class families forward.
Mike Bishop has Michigan legislative experience. Of course, he was Speaker of the House at one time. He has one term in Congress on his resume. How does your experience compare?
I'm not a career politician. I don't, you know, I'm not beholden to special interests. Mike Bishop might have political experience, but his experience has gotten us nowhere. I mean, in the state Senate, he shut down government. As a congressman, he shut down government. He's not getting anything done because he continues to put party before the betterment of the district. And if the people want somebody who's willing to stand up and get things done, then they won't vote for Bishop.
During the last election, Bishop won with more than 54% of the vote. The polling I've seen shows a trend toward a tighter contest this time, but he's leading. What has to happen for you to win on November 8th?
Well, I'm confident that we are going to have the resources and the votes to win in November. The people this year especially are tired. They're tired of the partisanship, tired of a broken Congress, tired of representatives that are beholden to their party instead of their constituents. And I'm confident that we're going to have the votes. People are excited about you know, this election and making sure that somebody like Donald Trump and Mike Bishop is not leading us.
Susanna Shkreli is the Democratic candidate in the 8th Congressional District. She's challenging Republican Mike Bishop. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Lester.
We twice contacted the campaign of Shkreli's opponent, the incumbent, Republican Mike Bishop. The campaign did not respond. In the last couple of weeks, we've offered to talk to the candidates in three of the most contested congressional races. The first district, where there's an open seat, we talked to Republican Jack Bergman and Democrat Lon Johnson. In the 7th district, we talked to Democrat Gretchen Driscoll. Republican Tim Walberg declined to talk with us. And today, well, you just heard about the 8th district. It's been an interesting election year. While we're on the topic, I'll be covering the results on election night. Michigan Radio and NPR begin coverage at 8 p.m. on Tuesday, November 8th. Don't forget to vote. Police shootings and the shooting of police have captured the attention of the people in a way that's not happened in decades. Conversations about race and respect for authority are dividing us. A new film explores those issues as a backdrop to its focus on the militarization of the police. The film is Do Not Resist. The director is Craig Atkinson, and he joins us now by Skype. Before we get too far into this, during this year, I wanted to let you know I've done several reports on a presidential commission appointed after the many civil disturbances throughout the country in 1967, including the uprising of black residents in Detroit. That commission, the Kerner Commission, came back with a blistering report about white attitudes towards black citizens and, more broadly, government treatment of those citizens, including how police treated black residents. It specifically warned against the militarization of police in 1968. So the question is this: just how militarized are police departments these days?
Well, I mean, if you look at the post 9/11 funding to police departments for equipment, the figure that we cite in the film is $39 billion. You know, $5 billion of that was through the DOD and about $34 billion was through DHS. The 1033 program, which is, you can trace the roots of it back to the Nixon administration, had been giving DOD equipment to police departments for the last three or four decades. But, you know, after 9/11 and the establishment of the Homeland Security Department, that was really the influx where you saw an additional $34 billion. And like any other business, you get the returns where you put the investment. And in this case, we happen to put it into equipment.
Yeah, let's talk about that 1033 program. You filmed a congressional hearing about the 1033. Members were asking about monitoring, whether anybody was watching to see how these military vehicles and things such as surplus bayonets were being used in light of the fact that they are explicitly banned from being used in the suppression of riots or demonstrations. What was the answer?
Yeah, the answer was that there is absolutely no oversight when this equipment goes out. That's the end of the oversight from the DOD or the DHS or the Justice Department. There really is no oversight whatsoever. You can look to Maryland to, as far as reporting statistics for SWAT, was the only state that actually had SWAT reporting statistics. And they only started that because the mayor of Berwyn Heights, Maryland, had his house raided by mistake. And after that, SWAT team shot his dog and he was very emotionally distraught over this experience, he pushed it through the legislation to get reporting statistics. So in 2010, they started to report when and how SWAT was being used. It came up for a ballot initiative in 2014 and they dropped that off of the initiative. So there no longer is reporting for any SWAT team throughout the country. And I think that that's part of the reason why we don't have good stats on how and when SWAT is being used. While it was being reported, it was very interesting. It basically paralleled the ACLU's finding, which over 90% of the SWAT deployments were for search warrants, and the vast majority of those were for drug search warrant cases. And that's our anecdotal evidence as well.
I want to get to that in a little bit, but I want to get a better idea why police feel they need these. In the film, they said that they're at even greater risk from armor-piercing bullets and other violence. One officer even explained that they need these armored vehicles and better military hardware because of the threat of Islamic State operatives. At a big police chief's convention, FBI Director James Comey said this:
"Monsters are barricaded inside apartments waiting for law enforcement to respond so they can fire rounds that will pierce a ballistic vest. Because of that reality, because monsters are real, we need a range of weapons and equipment to respond and protect our fellow citizens and protect ourselves."
So when you talked to police officers across the nation when you were doing this film, was that the general feeling among them?
Well, I think that most officers trace this back to the North Hollywood shooting. I mean, across the board, officers will cite that as a motivating factor to arm themselves. And that's when two individuals, put on body armor and robbed a bank in Hollywood. And, you know, police departments were so ill-equipped that they had to go to pawn shops in order to get equipment sufficient enough to neutralize that threat. And that was in the early 90s. I mean, I will tell you that the police officers that I spoke to, the vast majority were saying, yes, we're going to be using this to fight Al-Qaeda or ISIS, and that's why we're training. And in the training modules that we filmed, yes, they looked very equipped and well-prepared to handle something like that. And coming from a law enforcement family, I want our police officers to be well-equipped for these types of incidences. Look at the Pulse nightclub shooting where they took an armored vehicle and punctured a hole in the side of the nightclub and were able to free hostages. The unfortunate reality, though, is that while we keep saying we're preparing for the next terrorist event, which statistically is very, very rare, we're using the exact same equipment to do search warrants for oftentimes low-level offenses. The example that we show in the film is a home that's rated, that's supposed to be a drug kingpin, and it's a 22-year-old college student, and he has a gram and a half of weed, but yet he has to go to jail for that, and his property is seized under asset forfeiture. So there's a large disconnect between the stated reason for this equipment and how it's used on a day-to-day basis.
You mentioned your family being law enforcement. Your father was not only an officer for 29 years, but he commanded a SWAT unit in suburban Detroit starting in 1989. Now, since 89, police departments are getting, as you mentioned earlier, these tens of billions of dollars in military hardware through the 1033 program. They're getting all kinds of surveillance equipment and software that's being used to keep tabs on its own citizens, often without the residents knowing. What does your father think of the film and what it shows?
Well, you know, for someone that dedicated themselves so completely to the profession and approached it with a great deal of integrity, I think it was pretty heartbreaking for him to see how SWAT became a part of routine police work. I mean, in his era, you're only talking about 3,000 SWAT raids a year. And, you know, to give you some context, he was on SWAT for 13 years, and they only did 29 search warrants total. And you contrast that to teams that we were going out with of a similar size, and they're doing 3 to 4 raids a day, over 200 a year. And so I think it was incredibly disheartening for him to see a profession that he dedicated his life to evolve into something that I know that he wouldn't stand behind. You know, I think that he saw the value of SWAT using for the most violent situations and the one-off instances where you needed the heavy armament. But to do it as a routine part of police work, I think that he identifies that as an overreach of the tools that can be useful in other circumstances.
Your film opens in Ferguson, Missouri, when there were demonstrations going on about Michael Brown's death, and after the basically no charges were going to be filed against the officer who shot him. Was military gear used by law enforcement in Ferguson? And if so, why did they say it was necessary when for the most part, it was a peaceful demonstration?
Most well-trained departments never respond to protests in this manner. I mean, the protocol is basically put plainclothes officers amongst the protesters to help facilitate the protest because the people have the right to protest. Then you have the uniform officers. Then you have the riot officers. And then you have the SWAT team usually parked to the side because it's an eyesore for the community. And it also gives the community something to rally against if they see a opposing force. I mean, they're upset by the very nature of wanting to protest. They're obviously upset about something. So if you give them an outlet for that, such as a SWAT team on the front lines, that has a tendency to escalate the situation. However, you know, the opening shot of the film, it's on a SWAT team who's standing on the roadside in Ferguson, Missouri, and you see all of a sudden the protesters walk by. So instead of holding it back just to see if it was going to escalate into violence, they met the protest community with the full armament that they had been given to basically address a Fallujah-level attack or a ISIS-level of attack. So again, you know, here we are giving the equipment. There's no oversight on when and how it's going to be used. And there's a senator that mentions that it actually says that it cannot be used to quell protests or riots. And yet, despite that, that's stated in the DHS protocols, that's how it's being used. And with no oversight or reporting statistics, you can see how something like that can open itself up for abuse.
A number of police officials across the nation have been critical of how things were done in Ferguson, but they also say if police departments don't have this surplus military equipment, these big vehicles that SWAT teams use and so forth, wouldn't more officers' lives be at risk? What's your answer to that question?
Well, I'm, like I said, you know, there's some of the armored vehicles such as the MRAP, which was designed to resist roadside bombs overseas, and they're 45,000 pounds and they're prone to rollovers. And in fact, multiple law enforcement agencies have rolled these vehicles over. Something like that I feel is excessive. However, you know, you have a smaller armored vehicle known as the Bearcat, which is essentially, you know, on an F-250 chassis. Something like that can be very useful for law enforcement in the right circumstances. So again, let's keep it for the circumstances that you are selling to the community that it's going to be used for, and let's not bring it out on low-level search warrants where it just creates such ill will. And I think that we need to rethink how we're deploying such equipment in these communities, because it's just, you know, creating the type of environment where people start to resent the police presence. And obviously that's the exact opposite of what we're looking for from our police departments, and certainly in this day and age.
Your film, Do Not Resist, has received some critical acclaim. I'm wondering, what have some of the officers you met or talked to, have they had any comments about the results of participating in your film or the observations the film makes?
the one thing that I'm most shocked about is, has been law enforcement's response to the film. And I'll say that, you know, we screened at the John Jay Criminal Justice College in New York. And that's basically the NYPD's feeder school. And we had 300 people in attendance, and many of which were active duty NYPD. And many publicly got up and stated, thanks so much for making this film. It reflects reality. It shows areas of police work that actually need reform. So, you know, to be able to bring it to law enforcement and show law enforcement and to frame it as a teaching tool, so we're not condemning the individual officers in the film, but more so the style of policing, it's just been very encouraging that they're seeing it this way. And I think that we're going to be able to use that interest to parlay this into a multi-city police academy tour in order to bring the film to the very people who need to sit with it. And look at it in a very sobering way and ask ourselves, is this the best direction to move forward with policing? Is this really what the community is asking of their police in this day and age? So I'm hoping that we continue the conversation, include law enforcement in this conversation, not just the community, but all shareholders who are going to have a stake in the way that we move forward.
Craig Atkinson is the director of the film Do Not Resist. It's being shown by the Detroit Film Theater at the Detroit Institute of Arts tonight, Saturday and Sunday at 7 p.m. each night. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for being interested. I appreciate it.
Still to come on Stateside, wrongful convictions happen more for people of color. We'll hear about that from the Michigan Innocence Clinic. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Yesterday on Stateside, we brought you a Detroit Journalism Cooperative report on wrongful convictions. One of the people we interviewed for that story was David Moran. He's the co-founder of the Michigan Innocence Clinic at the University of Michigan. Today, we want to bring you a little more of that interview. Many of the Innocence Clinics base their work on DNA evidence, which has led to clearing the names and the release of hundreds of people. The Michigan Innocence Clinic operates a little differently. It pursues cases where DNA evidence is not even available. David Moran, yesterday's story talked about a finding in a Presidential Commission report from 1968. It reported complaints about discriminatory administration of justice for black Americans. What's been done in the nearly five decades to remedy that grievance?
Well, there have been some improvements nationally. I think it's undeniable that, for example, African Americans are better represented in police forces, especially urban police forces, than they used to be. They're also better represented in prosecutors' offices. So if there's racism in the charging decision, maybe there's an African American member of the prosecutor's office who can help alleviate that. And there's also more African American lawyers, defense lawyers, who are sensitive to the issues of race, and more African American judges. So the system has gotten more diverse. There are more members of minorities, including Latinos, Asian Americans, than there used to be. But obviously, we still have a long way to go.
On the Innocence Project website, about two-thirds of the people exonerated nationwide were African Americans. African Americans make up about one-third, a little more than one-third, of the inmates in state and federal prisons. Black people make up less than 13% of the population. What can you infer from those numbers?
Well, what those numbers show is that African Americans are more likely to be wrongfully convicted than white people are. Now, I should say the Innocence Project's data is a little bit skewed from what we see because they do DNA cases and DNA cases only.
Right.
And DNA cases are overwhelmingly sexual assaults. In sexual assault cases, when there's a wrongful conviction, it's usually because there was a bad eyewitness identification. And one of the leading causes of bad eyewitness identifications is cross-racial. So if you have a white or Hispanic victim identifying an African-American rapist, there's a better chance of a misidentification than if you had people within the same race identifying each other.
Why is that?
Well, the studies have consistently shown that people are much better at facial recognition of strangers of their own race than people of different races. So I think the DNA cases, and there's now over 300 of those exonerations since 1990, show that black people are more likely to be wrongfully convicted, which is true for the non-DNA exonerations, the kind of cases we handle in the Michigan Innocence Clinic as well. I don't think the numbers are quite as stark. There is something called the National Registry of Exonerations, which keeps track of DNA and non-DNA exonerations going back more than 25 years. And there were close to 2,000 of those registered exonerations, including 66, I think is the latest number, in Michigan. And again, there's a disparity. There are more African Americans DNA and non-DNA on the National Registry than the percentage of the inmate population nationally, but it's not quite as stark as the DNA numbers.
One of the things that I read on the Michigan Innocence Clinic website is that there are a number of causes. You just mentioned one of them, but government misconduct was also another. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. There are a number of other causes besides eyewitness misidentification that are especially prevalent in the non-DNA cases, including prosecutorial and police misconduct is a leading cause of wrongful convictions. And typically what we're talking about here is failure to turn over exculpatory evidence. So an investigation is done, evidence is gathered, but some of the evidence doesn't point to the person who's ultimately arrested and convicted, and that evidence doesn't make its way to the defense counsel, so it's not used at trial.
What would be the motivation to do that?
Well, I think in the vast majority of cases, it's unintentional. I don't believe in the vast majority of cases that the police or prosecutor set out to frame someone. I think what happens is they see a piece of evidence. It doesn't fit with their preconceived notion as to who did it. They've got a suspect. They develop tunnel vision. And then they get a piece of evidence that doesn't fit. And so they think, well, that's useless. That's wrong. And so they don't think of it as important to turn it over. When the defense lawyer sees that same piece of evidence, the defense lawyer says, oh my God, that's a piece of evidence pointing away from my client. And I'll give you a really good example if you have a minute.
Yes, please.
From Lansing. This is not one of our cases. This happened about 10 years ago. There was a fellow named Claude McCollum who was convicted of murdering a Lansing Community College professor named Carolyn Cronenberg. And Ms. Cronenberg was found dead in her classroom at Lansing Community College. Her students showed up to take the class, and they discovered the professor was dead. She'd been murdered. And there was only a fairly narrow window in which this murder could have occurred because the classroom had been used for an earlier class. The Lansing police immediately focused on Claude McCollum, who was a homeless, mentally ill man who often spent time on the Lansing Community College campus. They interrogated him. They extracted what they called a confession, which was basically a rambling statement of, maybe I could imagine committing this murder, and they convicted him. And it turned out, all this time, there was a video from the Lansing Community College Library showing that during the window during which Ms. Cronenberg was murdered, Mr. McCollum was asleep on a chair in the library. And that evidence wasn't turned over to the defense until it was discovered more than a year after Claude McCollum's confession. And the prosecutor and the police officer who didn't turn it over thought that the timestamp on the video had to be wrong. Therefore, this really wasn't exculpatory evidence. And how did they know the timestamp was wrong? Well, it had to be wrong because Claude McCollum confessed in their view. Well, it turned out that while Claude McCollum was sitting in prison, there was a man named Matthew Macon who was committing other murders in the Lansing area, and he was eventually caught. He was never formally charged for this murder, but it's widely believed that Mr. Macon was the real killer. So the tunnel vision here sent the wrong man to prison, left the real killer out on the streets where he committed more crimes, likely real killer, out on the streets where he committed more crimes during the interim. But I think it's a good example. I don't believe that the prosecutor thought he was framing an innocent man. He just thought he had a piece of information that wasn't real helpful to his case and wasn't useful. I should say that prosecutor, assistant prosecutor, was fired.
False confessions is something you bring up here, and that has been shown to happen a lot more than we ever would believe. People just can't imagine admitting to a murder that they didn't convict, but we've seen it because of some recent programs on cable TV or Netflix that show cases where there were false confessions. Are we coming to a new understanding about whether false confessions are more common than we thought?
Yes, definitely. 25% of the DNA exonerations have been false confession cases. And we're seeing
25%?
25%. About 75 of the more than 300 DNA exonerations. And we're seeing similar statistics for the non-DNA exonerations, including in my clinic. We've had several exonerations in my clinic where people falsely confessed. A case we just litigated this week in Wayne County Circuit Court, we have a client named Lamar Monson who gave what is a manifestly false confession taken by a detective under the supervision of a detective who was subsequently removed from the homicide unit because she was taking false confessions. So this is a sort of police misconduct we see where they make promises, they say sign the statement and you can go home, and the statement contains a false confession. Sometimes people are tricked into signing statements that they didn't actually make. You know, I wrote up what you said, just sign here, trust me, this is what you said, and it's not really what they said. Other times they're interrogated for hours and hours and they're told, you're not going home until you tell me what I want. And people think, well, finally, I can't take this anymore, I need to go home. And I can clear this up later because I know I'm innocent. And there's plenty of evidence that will show that. So false confessions are a real problem. The system is starting to catch on. In Michigan, a few years ago, Governor Snyder signed a bill requiring that interrogations be videoed at least in serious cases, and that's progress. So we can see, for example, when the police are feeding the suspect facts that he or she didn't otherwise know. We can see when coercive tactics are being used. We can see if the person's under the influence of something that might make their confession unreliable. But it's not enough. What we really need to have happen, and we're getting a growing movement for, is to change the way the police do interrogations in the first place, to follow the model that has been adopted, particularly in the United Kingdom. It's called the peace model. And there, instead of an adversary interrogation in which the police come in, as they've been trained to do in the United States for decades, which is, we know you did it, we're not going to listen to your denials, we're going to tell you over and over again you did it, and we're going to stay here until you tell me how you did it. Instead of doing that, police in Britain have been trained to an open-ended sort of interrogation where they basically say, just tell me what happened, and then pin the person down on the details. And if the person is lying, then the details are going to fall apart upon further inspection. So instead of doing a confrontational adversarial interrogation where the officer does almost all the talking, the peace method is have the suspect do all the talking. And if the suspect is guilty, if the suspect is lying, he or she is likely going to hang themselves.
We can't cover all of them because there are lots of different reasons for wrongful convictions, but I want to touch on one more. Bad lawyering is another contributor. What are the reasons behind that? I know Michigan has been looking at indigent defense rules, but are we seeing the kinds of changes we need to make sure that somebody who's poor and can't afford a lawyer and gets an appointed one is actually getting the kind of representation they should?
We're moving in the right direction, but we're nowhere near there yet. Michigan has one of the nation's worst systems for providing lawyers for poor defendants. So this is one of the reasons why I believe we see a strong disparity racially between who gets convicted and who doesn't. So the poorest counties and counties that have high minority populations in Michigan, we have a system in Michigan where it's county by county. There's no statewide system for indigent defense at all. So it depends on which county that you happen to be arrested in as to what kind of defense you're going to get. Well, the poorest counties have the fewest resources to provide adequate defense, and those are counties where you have a lot of minorities. So it's no surprise that about half of our caseload in the Michigan Innocence Clinic comes from Wayne County. It's Detroit, where they have no public defender office to speak of. They have instead a system of appointing private lawyers and paying them very little. And the way that cost structure works is that you simply can't do a good job and make a good living if your living is based on taking these appointments to do indigent defense. And so we've seen some of the same lawyers over and over again in our case who will take hundreds of cases and do basically no work on any of them. They have no time to do an investigation. They're not going to hire experts. They're not going to hire a private investigator. They're not going to talk to the witnesses. Because if they did that sort of work on any of the cases, well, then the whole thing would fall apart. They wouldn't have time to do any of the others. It's basically a plea mill, where they try and convince the clients that they should take the first plea offer that comes around, get the case off their docket, get paid, go on to the next case. It's a real problem. Now, we're starting to see progress in Michigan. The governor has signed a bill that created the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission, which is tasked with the job of coming up with a series of recommendations to the legislature and to the Michigan Supreme Court to improve indigent defense in the state. The problem is that the law creating the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission specifically says that they have to retain the county-by-county system. There can't be any statewide system. Michigan is one of only a small handful of states that does not have any kind of statewide system of public indigent defense.
If that's your preface from the beginning, it's a little self-defeating to have some kind of meaningful reform, though, isn't it?
Unfortunately, it is. So the Michigan Indigent Defense Commission seems to be getting off to a great start. They're proposing requirements, but the requirements then are for each county. So each county then has to implement the requirements to improve indigent defense in their county without necessarily having the resources to do it. There's nothing that prevents the legislature from stepping up and providing more money to counties to provide indigent defense. But what can't happen under the current system is a statewide system of public defense, which is really what Michigan needs.
Let's go back full circle. We see Black Lives Matter criticizing the justice system, criticizing police. It gets criticized for its protest on police shootings, mass incarceration. They're generally arguing, though, that African-Americans are not getting a fair shake, just the same way that African-Americans were saying it in 1967, 68. What society did then was ignore those pleas, those grievances. They instead elected Richard Nixon on a law and order platform. I'm wondering if anything has changed with this current movement and the response to it.
The cases we get are obviously not representative, because we see cases where the system completely misfired and the wrong person was convicted. And more often than not, that is a person of color in Michigan. It's easy to take those cases and say we can draw bigger lessons from them. And we do. We do draw bigger lessons about what went wrong. But of course, we don't see in my clinic, we don't see the cases where the system basically worked, where the right person got convicted after a fair trial and got the sentence that was appropriate and just. What we see is a disparity. We definitely see a disparity, and we talk about that in my clinic class about why the cases we see are racially skewed. And it's because of these systemic issues. It's because of under resources for defense counsel and urban courts, especially, where frankly, nobody has all the resources. The prosecutor's office doesn't have the resources, and the police department doesn't have the resources to do an adequate investigation. So it's not just the defense. It's these counties that are underfunded, typically places like Flint, Detroit, Benton Harbor, where there's large minority populations. So there's a systemic problem that leads to wrongful convictions. And that's really about the only piece of the puzzle in which I feel confident to talk about.
Between what we've seen with the Innocence Project and with your clinic, what kind of conclusions have you come to about wrongful convictions and race?
Well, I think it's undeniable, the statistics prove it, that if you are African American or Latino, you are more likely to be wrongfully convicted of a crime than if you are white. And it's typically not a case that the police picked up a person of the wrong race. That's not the issue. The issue is that they picked up a person who was the correct race in most of these cases, but the system failed, and the system was not as responsive as it would have been in the wealthier counties, the wealthier suburbs, to what was going wrong. The urban centers process so many cases, they don't really have time to think about how to try this case adequately, how to make sure this person is getting the measure of justice. If you go to Detroit, if you go to Wayne County Circuit Court, and this has been written about for decades, there's a real concern with case processing. We want to move cases as quickly as possible. Well, that maybe works great for the person who's guilty and wants to get a great plea deal, because the system wants to move the case as quickly as possible so he or she can maybe extract a pretty good deal from the prosecutor. But if you happen to be innocent, it's a really raw deal because all the pressure is on you to plead. All the pressure is for your case to go away as quickly as possible because we've got hundreds more coming in the door, and it's really hard to get a fair shake. And so it's simply a matter of resources. In my view, it's not a coincidence that the under-resourced courts, the under-resourced counties are the ones that have high minority populations.
David Moran is a law professor at the University of Michigan and co-founder of the Michigan Innocence Clinic. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Lester.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, Renaissance Journalism's Michigan Reporting Initiative, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
The autumn time change. We love that extra hour of sleep, but hate the fact the sun sets so early. But instead of looking at the situation as a glass half full, I say there are many reasons why the long nights are a blessing for all Michiganders. I can think of five off the top of my head. Come on, kids, let's count them out.
One!
You can eliminate that guilt of binge-watching a so-so TV show while the sun is out and the weather is nice. I mean, who cares if the show isn't any good? It's cold and dark out. It's not your fault you haven't raked the leaves yet. It's just that by the time you're home from work, it's too dark out. And everyone knows performing manual labor in the dark is dangerous.
Three!
Productivity for Michigan workers who identify as werewolves or vampires dramatically increases.
Four!
You can wave goodbye to those cancer-causing photons shooting at us from that nuclear fusion reactor we call the sun until next spring.
Five!
And finally, little-known fact, everyone, I mean everyone, is far more attractive in the dark. Long story short, we may not all like the twice annual time change, but keep in mind, messing with time changes might end up messing up our glorious long summer nights with their awe-inspiring sunsets. Something I'm willing to bet we can all agree makes Michigan extra special.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth.
Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Ryan Grimes, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Have a nice weekend.